science, civil, and religious systems which govern civilization. And he also amazingly authored the curriculum utilized by the thousands of members of the Dessert Club, which is basically, he has created a curriculum for young people to learn about their cultures. And you could see as he spoke of that inspiration. And so that is really essentially what this website, earthpeople.one, is about. And it's actually a communication tool. You can become a member, you can become a writer, researcher, and become a part of this, really digging up and documenting the truth of history, global history, like you were speaking of in your story about history didn't come to one point and then stop. And at the same time, we can't depend on one source to tell us what that history is.
Well, you know,
and we have to really document and research. But we got to go. Okay. Coming up will be Hour of the Wolf with Jim Freund. And this has been Heart of Mind, Earth at Midnight. I'm Catherine Davis in studio with Matmaza. And we will be back next week with some fabulous programming. My co-host Paulette Spencer is going to be coming in with a really amazing interview, and I'm sure that you will enjoy that. Stay tuned for Hour of the Wolf. This is Diane Reeves, Freedom Dance. Sweet.
must never end. In silent witness, I stand upon the rock of ages. Oh,
good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and, yes, the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. Well, it is now in New York anyway, September 8th. It is 50 years ago today that people went out to explore strange new planets and stuff like that. It's the 50th anniversary of the first broadcast of Star Trek. With me, John Ordover. We'll explain more about that, but we'll hear Dan Persons first, and we'll have a lot of fun. Just stay tuned.
I'm Dan Persons, not exactly a movie reviewer this time around, for Hour of the Wolf. It should be easy to talk about Star Trek's 50th anniversary, shouldn't it? Drop a few lines about Gene Roddenberry's optimistic view of the future, Mr. Spock, plywood sets, racial equality, Bill Shatner's waistline, and you're done. It's being done like that all over the place. I can't do that. If I'm talking about a particular episode or a particular film, I can focus down, weigh the merits of that particular work. But to talk about the whole of Trek, 50 years of it, that addresses something fundamental in me, something I've never fully explored. Right now, on the wall behind me, as I speak, I've mounted a replica of the intercom panel from the USS Enterprise from the original series. If you don't remember it, on screen, it wasn't all that much. A red rectangle with a wedge-shaped signal light, another round red light, a push button, and a speaker grid. And yet, the first time I saw it being offered on the Think Geek website, and it's still available there, it's not that expensive if you're into that kind of thing, I didn't hesitate to buy it. And more, at first sight of it, I knew I had to have it, had to have its physical presence, had to be able to push that button. Even more, if I turn now and look at that intercom, that odd and not very artful conglomeration of science fiction widgets, button and lights and speaker grill, a sensation comes over me that I can only describe as a sense of peace and satisfaction. Okay, I think the word I'm looking for here is fetish. Let me add that on a shelf below that intercom rests a replica of the original series tricorder, phaser, and communicator, along with a few replicas from Next Gen and even some from J.J. Abrams films. Looking at them invokes the same feelings of serenity. Playing with them, which I do, brings a profound sense of joy. To fetishize something is to imbue it with a power it doesn't really have. The physical thing enforces the fantasy, and vice versa. This is usually put into a sexual context, but it doesn't need to be. It could be that the object evokes a world, a future one dreams of. I have experienced all 50 years of Star Trek in real time. I was 11 years old when The Man Trap, the first Star Trek episode to air, debuted, and I was stunned. Lost in Space primed my interest in science fiction, but Star Trek set the hook. At an age when I wasn't prone to deep analysis, the show attached itself to me in ways I couldn't begin to understand. It happened on two fronts. One was its pure physical nature, the bridge of the Enterprise, its corridors, the look of the ship as it moved through space. There was a special this past weekend on National Geographic where one person noted that the Enterprise wasn't designed to be a real spaceship, but to look beautiful. And it did. The disc and engineering section and nacelles giving it a dimensionality that no other screen spaceship, or real-life spaceship for that matter, had. Back in college, I actually wrote a paper about how the design of the Enterprise was used to tell dramatic stories. To 11-year-old me, there was a palpable realness to it. For all the plywood that went into the scenery and styrofoam rocks that littered the planet's surfaces, it was a future that seemed attainable, that I could see myself inhabiting. And then there was the second front, that this was not just a future I could live in, but that I would want to live in. At that point in my life, I wasn't really focused on issues like racial equality and war and peace, but when Captain Kirk screamed to the Metrons that there would be no more killing today, when Spock mind-melded with visibly terrifying Horta and discovered something that equated to true humanity within, Roddenberry's master plan was enacted in me in its purest form. The boy that I was, who was just evolving out of the binary comfort of good and evil into a more nuanced perception of the world, subliminally grasped the message of humanity striving to be better, more open, more understanding. That this was all set in the context of grand adventure, buoyed by William Shatner's attitude that whatever the dangers, space was going to be a downright gas. And for whatever sins Shatner committed on and off camera, let's all admit that nobody could have conveyed that feeling better than he did. It just made it all the more desirable. We could be great, and the future could be fun. There's another thing about fetishism, an almost instinctual understanding that whatever you fixated your fantasies on, it isn't the real thing. The tricorder on my shelf is just a plastic box with some lights and a sound effects chip. The Star Trek future, traveling through space at warp speeds and encountering life forms whose lives are at least somewhat analogous to our own, is, by the laws of physics and probability, a near impossibility. And looking at how humanity has progressed in the 50 years that Star Trek has been around, there's definite progress, but there's still so much we need to do to hit Roddenberry's vision of true harmony, Earth as paradise. The danger of fetishism is fixating on the fantasy to the exclusion of all else, letting the ideal distract from what we can make reality. There will be a new Trek next year, and I am looking forward to it. I'm still not sure I'm willing to cough up $6 a month to experience it with commercials yet, but we can talk about what a lovely future Roddenberry had dreamed for us. It means nothing if we don't let that dream guide our actions, make life better, richer, more fun, more exciting. Beaming down to a planet may be forever beyond our reach. Becoming better as humans is certainly within our grasp. The great bird probably would have agreed. I'm Dan Persons. Now is the time to take a stand against hatred, fear, and greed. Register to vote, and let's defeat Trump.
That was really, really good, Dan. I really liked that. Thank you. Next week, he'll be back to doing movie reviews, no doubt. Before we open up John's mic, and actually, John, tap your mic. Let's see if it's working. Nope. Try it again. Okay, I'm going to open them all. Okay. Yeah, but which one? There. Okay, I found it. Thank you. I need to promote stuff. Like tomorrow night's tonight, because it's 1:44, if the clock at WBAI is correct, which is, it's 1:44 in New York City. So this is the official anniversary. My show just happened to fall on it. But what is not a coincidence is that we arranged to have the sort of preview of this season's New York Review of Science Fiction readings debut tomorrow night, or tonight, Thursday night. Okay, Thursday night, starting at 7 p.m. here at 388 Atlantic Avenue with, I should have printed all this stuff out. I know it by now. A recorded Skype interview. We were going to do this live, but our tech person, I hope that listeners here remember and know Terrence Taylor, who's a fine writer, but he's also the tech person for the reading series, had a family event occur that prevented him from being here, and therefore putting Skype on live stream and stuff like that made it difficult. So our guest curator, Keith DeCandido, did record an interview with him, which we will show on the video screen here. And we'll film the we'll show you on live stream. You can see the video screen, but it's not exactly incorporated in. So we will see how that goes. But in addition to that, David Mack and, oh my God. See, I knew I should have printed this out. Okay. Do you remember the woman's name, John, who we have? She blogs about Star Trek and Star Wars and stuff for Tor.com.
Sorry.
Okay, and Keith DeCandido, plus a sketch. If I I do have a working computer here. There are three computers. I can't begin to tell you about the issues that we often have dealing here with stuff at WBAI. But let's see. How many windows of WeTransfer is it necessary for people to have opened? Okay. And, let me tell you, folks, whoever is signed into their email should sign out. I should never have seen what I just saw. Oh, Reggie, shame on you. Log out. When you leave this room, log out. Okay. So I have to go to my own page, ourwolf.com. You all can do it as well. Or if you're on Facebook, you can go to the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings group, or for that matter, the Hour of the Wolf group, and get the information there. And here we are. Now I've got it in front of me, so I'm not just... I owe an apology, but I've never met Emily Asher Perrin, who will be performing. So, okay, so Keith R.A. DeCandido, a John Ordover creation, as is David Mack, has been a Star Trek fan since birth, having grown up watching the show in reruns on Channel 11. He's a kid. Like Dan, I watched it live. I remember the day it was on the air. I remember watching it. I guess I was about Dan's age. What I wasn't aware of was that on that same day, Gordon Van Gilder was busy being born. So let me say happy 50th birthday, Gordon. And Simon Locally of WBAI had two words of advice for me about a 50th birthday. That a 50th birthday gives you, A, the right to say, welcome to L. Haha, Roman numbering. And number two is that you can now start any conversation by saying, you know, for the better part of a century, I've always believed that such and such. So, happy birthday, Gordon. So, let's see. Keith DeCandido, okay, we're going to have a lot of good stuff, all right? I'm not going to read the whole thing. You can go online to ourwolf.com or to Facebook's Nursef group and read this, but I will give you the intro. I will tell you, by the way, what does it mean, by the way, John, when it says on Stardate minus 27 as the first thing?
I haven't the slightest idea. You posted it.
Yeah, no, I on my calendar. There's a little add-on calendar that allows you to know the day's star date.
I suppose it's counting up to the time when star dates were first introduced in the future.
Yeah.
I haven't the slightest idea.
So that's probably centuries? No, it can't be centuries. Decades?
Okay.
Minus 27? How many decades are we from when the Enterprise is
supposedly
launched?
Supposedly, the NTC-1701.
Right.
With no A's, B's, C's, D's, E's, or X's.
Yeah.
Is from the 23rd century. Exactly when is not specified.
Okay. So 200 years from now, roughly. This is the 21st century.
Right. So about 200 years from now. And the star dates were originally supposed to increase one each production order, but they got aired out of order.
Right. Of course.
Yeah.
As they so often do. Anyway, the star date today is minus 27-04610. That is today's star date. Let's see. So, as I said, a recorded interview with Stephen Barnes, who wrote DS9 episode Far Beyond the Stars.
He wrote the novelization of Far Beyond the Stars.
Oh, who novelized? Yeah, I didn't see. I wasn't reading my own copy.
I happened to edit that.
New York Times best-selling author David Mack, co-writer of two DS9 episodes, co-authored with somebody.
With me.
Yes, right. And author of dozens of Trek novels, which you were the editor of.
Well, actually, I don't think I edited any of Dave's novels.
Really?
I certainly brought him in, but other editors.
But what about the 50th anniversary novel? Are those yours?
I haven't worked for Star Trek since 2003.
Okay, at all. At all.
No.
Okay. So, et cetera, et cetera. So the evening, and Emily Asher Perrin, who is basically a blogger for Tor.com and a fascinating young self-described queer woman. I don't know. Many of us are weird. And a performance of a comedy skit about Trek fandom written by New York Times best-selling Trek novelist Dayton Ward. Okay. Yes, John.
Also, John Ordover Discovery.
Okay, fine. So, that's tomorrow night. Doors open at 6:30. Admission is free, free, free. We do, however, bug you for donations, preferably about $7. We'll take more. Here at 388 Atlantic Avenue, ground floor, the Brooklyn Commons. And that's it. So a lot of what John Ordover, our guest this morning, hath wrought will be on stage. So I was surprised that Keith didn't like get you on there like almost immediately.
Well, I guess the important thing is that I'm on the radio now and I get to take credit for them.
Yes. Okay. There you go. Yeah, well, you introduced me to Keith. John was also the owner of the...
Soho Gallery for Digital Art. You were going to get it wrong, I could tell.
No. No, I know that by heart, but I am concentrating on three things at once. Because I'm switching computers here, because there's only one that's online and another one that will play certain programs. And I've also transferred the files that I brought with me over to the computer, so they're not on my keychain, which has a flash drive on it, that I've left here 2 weeks in a row.
Well, see, the phrase, you were going to get it wrong, I could just tell, is actually a quote from Bob Ray.
There we get it. Okay. Except not spoken by a member of the... Slow talkers. Kurt. Okay, I won't do it.
Yes.
It is simply one of the funniest bits.
And lifted hole for Furtopia.
Yes. Yes. Brilliant, brilliant, yeah. Brilliant. It holds up. It really holds up. Ah, so now that I switch over those sounds to another player, let's get back to our ambience. And hope that the volume is still set correctly. Is it? No. There we go. There we go. Now we're on the bridge. Yep, door just opened. Okay, very good. So, when I do a Doctor Who show, I've got TARDIS sounds in the background.
Of course,
so yeah, naturally. We have a lot of fun stuff to listen to, including a really cool gift, which, by the way, we will have on sale at the free reading tomorrow, or you can just buy on your own the Skyboat Media production of The City on the Edge of Forever. Disclaimer, I do a lot of work with Skyboat Media, mostly as I'm the host and audio editor of the... podcast Lightspeed for Lightspeed magazine. We won the Hugo 2 years in a row for best semi-prozine. Not eligible this year because we're no longer a semi-prozine. We're now a prozine. And guess what? There's no prozine category. So, not eligible. Yeah, John is furrowing his brow at that. No, what they have is best editors. You're supposed to vote for John Joseph Adams or Neil Clark or Ellen Datlow, who always wins, and deservedly so, may I say. But there should be a prozine category. There really ought to be. And, you know, then it's like us versus the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction versus Clark's World versus Uncanny, which won Best Semi-Prozine this year. A fine, fine magazine edited by Lynn Thomas, who's been on this show when she was but a geek talking about Geeks Love Time Lords. But just an anthology she edited. Anyway. Also, Skyboat Media put out, I never promote this, a CD or download, if you prefer, called Chatting Science Fiction, which is 15 interviews from some radio program that you're listening to right now called Hour of the Wolf. And it includes Ursula K. Le Guin and Connie Willis. The Willis interview is fabulous. Ken Liu. Lots and lots of fun stuff. So I do have an interest with Skyboat Media, although outside of the Chatting SF CD, which they put out, I haven't done any editing for them this year because times is tough. But they did put out a vast, big production, which you're going to hear a couple of bits from, of Harlan Ellison's original screenplay of The City on the Edge of Forever, which is quite controversial over, which is the one true screenplay. John, what do you know about that?
I know that Harlan wrote a great script, and then the typical process, having gone through it myself, is multiple revisions, that Harlan wasn't happy about that.
No, yeah, he doesn't like people editing his work.
Right, and the story goes, as I heard it, is that once he saw the aired episode, he went into Gene Roddenberry's office with a rope, tied it to a beam on the ceiling, put the rope noose around his neck, stood on a chair, and said, "Tell me someone didn't rewrite my words."
Right. I've heard the story, only it involved an axe.
Right. Well, that's whichever. The point is, Harlan was annoyed.
Yeah. Oh, well.
Yeah. Either way, it's a fantastic episode and an excellent script. I tend to come down somewhere in the middle by saying it wasn't producible on the TV of the era in its an original form.
Yeah.
But
it is producible as an all-star radio drama today, which Skyboat Media put out.
Really? Was that Skyboat Media that put that out?
No, it was Skyboat Media.
Oh, okay, Skyboat Media.
And what they have is a special 50th anniversary edition, which has Ellison's Punim on the front, staring out at you, and I'm trying to get...
For those of you in the FCC, a punim is a face.
Yeah. And I'm trying to get this computer to like it. They need to get married, or at least have
a casual encounter.
Yes. Pardon me. Try to get that in there, and I really, really hope that we can play you a portion of it. I went and got the permission for it and everything. Ooh, found new hardware, it says. A problem occurred during hardware installation. Your new hardware might not work properly. Well, that's... Should I try the other computer? I suppose I must, because I want to play... There's an introduction to the story of the episode. There's all kinds of additional stuff. And this is a rare item. This is the 50th anniversary original teleplay edition, which actually comes in a little... it was made for the big Star Trek con that was held in Las Vegas about 2 weeks ago. And there was also an audiobook show where they did it, and it comes in this little special case and comes with a bottle opener that says Edith Keeler on it. Edith Keeler, for those who aren't that familiar with the show, is Joan Collins. She was the...
And she was married to Tom Collins, that's why you need a bottle opener.
Yes, exactly, which is why I don't remember it. I'm having a blackout. Okay, I'm looking for the USB insert on the other computer to see if it'll work there. We have other stuff to play, but I would really like to promote this. Because I haven't even heard it myself. I didn't get to work on it, since it's a full cast production starring John Rubenstein as... Kirk, and do you remember other people in there?
No.
Yeah, some guy named LeVar Burton.
Oh, yeah, him.
There's a whole bunch of folks. You could go to skybookmedia.com and get more information on it. Okay, so I now got the thing going in there. But you can also download this by going to skyboatmedia.com and listening to it there. And maybe we'll play some other stuff first, so that when I'm not trying to talk on the air over WBAI New York, we can concentrate a little bit more on getting this thing working. It's just a little bit, just a wee bit confusing to me. Okay. Nothing new, as regular listeners know. Should we play another bit now, John? You know what I've got on tap. Explain to us your job at Pocketbooks. Start with that.
Well, first of all, let me once again stress that I haven't worked at Pocketbooks since 2003.
Right. But you were there for...
11 years.
Right.
11 years. My job was to edit and help create the Star Trek line. And it was working with dozens and dozens of freelance writers, all of whom were very committed Star Trek fans.
I think the original Star Trek books was a series written by James Blish, which were...
That predates Pocket.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
Which were...
Adaptations. Short story adaptations.
Of actual episodes.
Right.
Then I think there was a short, brief series at Bantam.
That's correct. Then Paramount bought Simon & Schuster and moved the publishing over to Simon & Schuster.
And Simon & Schuster, in turn, swallowed Pocketbooks.
Right. I think Simon & Schuster... Simon & Schuster were always a part of... Pocketbooks.
Was Pocketbooks always an imprint?
I believe the guys named Simon and Schuster actually started Pocketbooks.
Oh, okay.
Someone will correct me. And the original Star Trek line at Pocket was started by David Hartwell, who we unfortunately lost this year.
I didn't realize that he started the line.
Yeah.
Yeah. David Hartwell, who's... was also the publisher of the New York Review of Science Fiction magazine, which continues, and which the reading series that I curate is named after, had an incredible influence on, like, all aspects of the science fiction publishing industry at a lot of different publishers.
And basically the idea was to develop a Star Trek story of... both Star Trek and Star Trek Next Generation, and then start up the Deep Space Nine line from scratch, and then start up the Voyager line from scratch, find lots of authors who I knew were talented and who could tell good stories. There were two major innovations I brought to the line. One was doing connected series like that would involve all the existing shows at the time, like Star Trek Invasion, Star Trek The Captain's Table, which were various things that were multi-book series that continued either thematically or in story from one book to the next. And then the biggest contribution I made that's still going on in some ways was to, with Peter David, I sat down and created Star Trek New Frontier, which was a ship and crew that existed only in the book form.
Mm-hmm.
Because that way we didn't have to worry about conflicting with what was being established at high speed on the show. One of the things people didn't understand is when there was a weekly Star Trek TV show, books take about optimally 9 months to a year from concept to published book. The TV show takes about 3 weeks. So the books would always lag way behind, and sometimes things would be established on the shows that would conflict with things we've been doing in the books. Perhaps the biggest one that had me banging my head against the wall was when, toward the end of Star Trek Deep Space Nine, they revealed that Dr. Bashir was an advanced human created by the same technology as Khan.
Yeah.
And he turned out to be nice, but not all of them did. In any case... So what did that mean? That meant the 20-odd...
And he doesn't look anything like Benedict Cumberbatch.
No. He was 20 or 30 books in when suddenly we find that from the very beginning, when we were in Dr. Bashir's point of view, he at least should have known that he was an enhanced human being. And he, especially in scenes like in Esther Friesner's wonderful book, when there's basically a solo mission for Dr. Bashir... that the whole time he was struggling to overcome the issues he was facing about really being a frontier doctor he had talked about, he should have known that he could have lifted a giant rock or he could have shot the thing. And the readers were always saying, how come it doesn't keep up with the shows? And the answer is always the same thing. Shows move much faster.
Yeah, they're having a similar problem in both the Marvel and the DC universe with the TV shows. Now, Marvel has the streaming Marvel shows and the television shows and the movies. And because they all work at a different rate, it's very difficult to get, like, you know, a tie-in to what's going on in the movies, which can take two to three years to write and make.
Which is why both the comic books and from both Marvel and DC are simply ignoring the movies and TV shows.
Yeah. I'm pleased to say, by the way, that I got the damn thing working.
Okay.
Let me tell you about the cast, of course. Your friend, Peter David, is actually played by Stefan Rudnicki, with whom I do a lot of work. There's a treatment. The voice is Robert Forster, fine actor. Orson Scott Card, famous writer. LeVar Burton is the narrator of the teleplay prologue. John Rubenstein is Kirk. LeBeck is Alex Hyde White, who is a fine actor on his own and plays in the third Indiana Jones film when Harrison Ford's father is young. Sean Connery is young. That was Alex Hyde White. And Alex Hyde White, more importantly, is the son of Wilfred Hyde White, which movie fans, you know, think Pickering and My Fair Lady and God knows how many films Wilfred Hyde White is. So it's fun for me. I get to do a number of editings for Alex Hyde White. Called him up expecting this perfect British accent. Absolutely. And it's like, yellow. Well, of course, the guy was born in Hollywood, so that figures. Scott Brick, who's a famous audiobook narrator, is Spock. In the teleplay, Act One, the narrator is David Gerald, who, of course, wrote The Trouble with Tribbles. Rand is played by Judy Young. I love her voice work. Stefan Rudnicki is the Guardian. Of Forever. The Renegade is Paul Bamer. Now, Paul Bamer, J. Paul Bamer, I know him as just this magnificent narrator, and I was doing, editing a story written by Sam J. Miller, who's been on this show any number of times. And I told Sam, oh, by the way, your story is read by Paul Bamer. He said, Paul Bamer of Star Trek? I don't know what Paul has to do with Star Trek. Well, it turns out that Paul has done so many voices for aliens, for cartoon series, for different things here and there, and has appeared in costume in all the various shows. He may very well have done more appearances and more treks than any other actor. So how Sam knew this, I don't know, but this is Paul Bamer here. Also in here, included in the cast, are Gabrielle DeCure. Jean Smart plays Edith Keeler. They aren't messing around here. The Trooper in Act 4 is Harlan Ellison. And what names haven't I mentioned? LeVar Burton plays Leonard Nimoy. Melinda Snodgrass is played by Bonnie McBird. That is actually her name. I questioned it when I first edited a story by that she was narrating, and Stefan Rudnicki told me, yes, there actually is a birth certificate to prove that is her name. So how about...
But who plays the tricorder?
Oh, I thought I had sent you this very document.
Yes, but I just don't remember the name.
I don't. Let's see here. Because I was looking at the cast and not the roles that people were playing. Stefan did Sulu. Of course he did. Let's see. Gabrielle DeCure.
Okay,
of
good.
Course.
Plays
of
the
course.
Tricorder.
Yes, she does. She does. Gabrielle is such a fabulous voice. She's an amazing narrator. And yeah, she could do Majel Roddenberry or Majel Barrett Roddenberry.
But in the show, I don't know what it is.
No, the tricorder doesn't have a voice.
It doesn't. It just goes.
Yeah, well, in radio drama,
Yes.
We do some of those effects.
But also there is a point where the tricorder plays some stuff back that was from various newsreel stuff.
So. Yeah. And Gabrielle sent me an email. Damn it, I didn't bring it here. About which would be good bits to play, but she said it's all good, and I believe that. So, do you want to hear a piece of this now, John?
Sure.
Yeah, we'll just like drop the needle on the record. This is cut one, CD one, if it were a CD, and you can get it in CD format, by the way, but this is the special flash drive edition. Introductory essay, Perils of the City, by, of course, Harlan Ellison.
Perils of the City. Speak no ill of the dead? Oh, really? Then let's forget about writing a true introductory essay to this book. Let's give a pass to setting the record straight. Let's just shrug and say, what the hell, it's been more than 30 years, and the bullshit has been slathered on with a trowel for so damn long, and so many greedy little pig snouts have made so much money off those lies. And so many.
Oh dear, did I choose the wrong bit to play? I should have known the moment that I saw Harlan's name. This man has gotten me into so much trouble over the years. Right after the Carlin incident, I played his brilliant reading of his story, Shatterday, and got a suspension notice from the FCC. And, oh my, he was so thrilled. He thought that there would be a Supreme Court case, and he said they're going to call it the Carlin Ellison case and all that. And our lawyers were sort of thrilled because they thought it was so defensible. And because Harlan is such an important writer and big name and all that. And the Department of Justice decided do not pursue this FCC, and it was dropped, for which I am very, very grateful. But that guy has gotten us, and Pacifica Radio, he did a lot of hanging out at KPFK on Mike Hodel's radio program. I should have known that it didn't take 60 seconds, did it? Before I had to hit the bleep button, which I trust I did in time. How about prologue? That might be safe. Let's give it a whirl, shall we?
Prologue. Fade in, scene one. Establishing shot, angle in space. The USS Enterprise hanging in mid-foreground over a strange, silvery planet under a wan and dying red sun. Camera moves in on ship, and over this and subsequent pantomime shots, we hear the voice of Kirk.
Ship's log, stardate 3134.6. Our chronometers still run backward. We have followed the radiation to its planet source here at the rim of the galaxy.
Great.
But something else is happening. When we left Earth, each of the 450 crew members of the Enterprise was checked out stable. But it's been 2 years. So much stress on them. We have continuous psych probes, but we know some have been altered. Even some who may have gone sour. We can't know till the flaw shows up. And by then, it's too late. Much too late.
While voiceover carries, camera moves in on Enterprise smoothly till we rapid lap dissolve to scene two. Interior Enterprise, Beckwith's cabin, extreme close-up, on a small, isometrically shaped metal container as it is opened by hand. Voiceover is heard after beat as we hold close on the lid of the box, opening with tambour doors, so the interior of the box rises and a strange, dull light floods the frame. As the container opens, the black velvet interior slides up to reveal possibly half a dozen glowing jewels. They are faceted solids, but not stone, more like a hardened jelly that burns pulsing with an inner light, gold, blue, crimson. As Kirk's voiceover ends, we hear,
Beckwith, stop it. Give me one.
Camera pulls back to medium two-shot, showing Lieutenant J.G. Lebec, a French-Canadian with a strong face, a face now beaded with sweat, a face in torment, and another officer, Richard Beckwith, a man whose face shows intelligence and something else. Cunning, perhaps, or even subdued cruelty. Beckwith holds the pulsing
okay,
jewels in their
right
container.
Now, that gives
he smiles
you
unpleasantly
taste,
as Lebec
nice
stares
taste.
Transfixed by the
Let
jewels.
Let us segue to
without
another
moving,
favorite
taunts him with
Star
them.
Trek audio moment.
Jewels of sound. So expensive, so illegal.
Ah, but as usual, I screwed up the technology on the Segway. So we're just going to start it again, bring the volume up, and here we go. Are you ready, Frank Heller, Peter Zanger, Boris Bobby Pickett, or Bobby Boris Pickett, and Peter Ferrara? I hope you have your act together.
Spaced. The final frontier. These are the voyages of the starship Booby Prize. Its five-year mission? To sell t-shirts, toy phasers, plastic communicators, and anything else we can think of. To seek out new life in old plots and complications. To boldly go where everyone has gone before.
Star Trek.
Captain's log, stardate 6935.2. We are in orbit around the planet Schwartz.
Engineering to Captain Jerk. Engineering to Captain Jerk.
Jerk here. What is it, Snotty?
Captain, the warp drive engines are generating excess antimatter. The pods are overloading now. If it continues at this rate, I can't be responsible for the safety of the ship.
I want answers, mister.
Well, I tried shoving a wiener in the warp drive, but it didn't do a bit of good. By the by, would you have a wee bit of mustard up on the bridge?
Mr. Schlock?
No mustard, Captain.
Analysis, Schlock?
It would appear that Lieutenant Snot is about to eat wiener without mustard.
As always, your logic is impeccable, Mr. Schlock. Dr. McGoy?
I'm a doctor, not a scriptwriter!
Sensors, Mr. Schlock?
Computer data coming in now. It's exactly what we need, Jim. A colossal negative space turkey of infinite power coming right at us at warp factor 11.
Commence evasive action, Mr. Lulu?
Yes, Captain Jack.
Evasive action's ineffective, Captain. The turkey is turning with us and closing rapidly.
Estimated time of impact?
Approximately 16.24 seconds, Captain. Then again, I could be a little off.
Readings, Mr. Schlock.
Off the scale, Captain. I have not encountered this phenomenon before.
Damage report, Lieutenant Minora?
Honey, I'd say we've taken a shellacking out here.
Bridge to engineering.
Snot here, Captain.
What's not there, Snotty?
I said snot here, Captain.
Snotty, give me full power. Get us out of here fast.
Ach, I cannot do it. The toilets are bound up into the warp drive mechanism. It'll take time to make repairs.
Fascinating.
What, Mr. Schlock?
The program's almost over, and you haven't yet found an alien to fall in love with.
Recommendation?
I'd suggest we beam down to the planet's surface and hang out, Captain.
Logical, Mr. Schlock. Perfectly logical. Mr. Lulu, you've got the con.
Thank you, Captain Jack.
Into the elevator, Mr. Schlock. Elevator, transporter room.
I'm fine. How are you?
Elevator, I said transporter room.
I'm fine. How are you?
No, forget it. Fine. Elevator to engineering. Beam us down from here, Snotty.
Aye, aye, Captain. You're locked on coordinates now.
Energize, Mr. Snot.
Remarkable.
What do you make of it, Mr. Schlock?
There is no record of any such civilization as this on the planet Schwartz, Capitan.
Look, Schlock, here comes a car, and feast your Vulcan squinties on that driver.
Far out, Captain Jerk.
Looks like the Starfleet's in. Want a lift, sailor?
As a matter of fact, I do. Well, I'll say goodbye here, Schlock. Now you'll have what you've always wanted, command of the Booby Prize.
And you'll have what you always wanted, Jimbo.
And what is that, Mr. Schlock?
A bleach blonde in red convertible on planet Schwartz.
Right on, Schlock. Say bye-bye to Starfleet Command for me, and I'll see you on Hollywood Squares.
Bye-bye, Jim.
Say, Space Fox, what's your sign?
Oh, dangerous curves.
I thought he'd never leave. Schlock to booby prize.
Snot here, Mr. Schlock.
What's not there, Lieutenant Snot?
I said snot here, Mr. Schlock.
That's Captain Schlock.
Aye?
And make it one to beam up.
Zero hour, 9 a.m. And I'm gonna be high as a kite by then.
And I bet he was.
I miss the earth so much.
Embarrassing.
I miss my wife.
Isn't it?
It's lonely out in space. On such a timeless flight. And I think it's going to be a long, long time till touchdown brings me around again.
I screwed it up again. Oh, well. The segueing between two computers. But you know what? I suspect that the audience will thank me for not playing all of that version of Rocket Man. I just didn't want it to end quite so abruptly. Star Drek, of course, was originally a production done here at WBAI by Frank Heller and Peter Zanger, and is a classic. There was another version. There was an original version, which sadly Frank, who sent me the link to the single that was later put out, which is what you heard, did. And yeah, it was just as offensive as this one was. I hadn't listened to it, and well, it is over 30 years old, and I trust that the politics of the era has changed at this point. John Ordover is the guest here on Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. We are celebrating the 50th anniversary of the first broadcast of Star Trek. Another thing we neglected to mention about your tenure at Pocketbooks, this is an observation of mine. Okay. We're getting what sound like EBS alerts, but I'm not sure from where they're coming. Not my phone. Wait.
It's George Lucas trying to sabotage our celebration.
Yeah, no. One has to pay attention to certain things by FCC rules and regulations. Okay. At any rate.
So, what have I not mentioned about my tenure?
That what you did by being the editor, the keeper of the keys to the Star Trek universe in print, was that you were giving work to a lot of great science fiction writers who slave away at short stories and novels on mid-list at best in the era, you know, not really able to make a living at their craft. Fine, fine, brilliant writers. And you gave them a respite. Take a month. How long do you think, how long did it take?
It varies writer to writer.
Haldeman.
You have to remember, I didn't start till 92. I wasn't there when Dave Hartwell hired Joe Haldeman.
Okay. It was Hartwell to start. Okay.
Yes.
So, but name some of the writers that you did have.
Moses Scott, for example.
Okay.
Gavith Abhew. Let's see. I brought in Greg Cox. I brought in...
People of... Now, they were not famous, really, until they started writing work-for-hire adaptations.
Well, my goal was, and sometimes it worked out and sometimes it didn't, was to find great writers who were getting fantastic reviews, winning awards, but for their original work, but not selling that many copies. So they weren't paying the bills.
Right, exactly.
Melissa Scott is a good example.
But there are some other name writers that you brought in.
Stephen Barnes.
Yes.
Stephen Barnes.
There's a great example.
Stephen Barnes novelized. I had been trying to get Stephen Barnes for quite a while. And I kept calling his agent every couple of months and saying, hey, how about Steve Barnes? Because frankly, for Star Trek, this symbol of multiculturalism and diversity, everybody was white. And Octavia Butler said no.
Mm-hmm.
N.K. Jemisin may not have been born yet. I don't know how old she is.
Nora,
yes.
Our guest last week.
Yes, she may not have been born yet. Chip Delaney said, I'd love to, but I don't think you'd publish what I'd write now.
Oh, God. He would have written, you know, he would have Slash.
Slash fiction.
For those who don't know, Slash Fiction was a form. It's got more formal names now, but it meant originally it was pretty much a Star Trek thing. It was Kirk slash Spock, a way for people to romance the two together and write fanfic that would have romantic entanglements that you were not likely to find in the mainstream. And yeah, Chip would have gone well beyond.
Yes.
Where no one has gone before.
So Stephen Barnes, agent kept saying he was too busy. He wouldn't be interested in, he was interested in his original work. But then we got in the script for what I think is probably the single best episode of Star Trek Deep Space Nine, which is called Far Beyond the Stars. And it basically tosses the whole Deep Space Nine format out and has everybody playing the staff and writers for a 1950s era science fiction magazine.
I agree. Now that I hadn't realized Stephen Barnes had written that. It makes so much sense.
He didn't write the episode.
Who wrote the episode?
I believe, actually, we were talking about him earlier today. I think it was Mark Zickrey.
Mark Zickrey, okay. Who, by the way, we're going to have an interview with at 3:30. What we're going to do is we're going to play an old Hour of the Wolf that will take us up to 5 a.m. And that will include an interview that I did 10 years ago. It's a 10-year-old show with Mark Zickrey and also some words at a Nebula Awards function about the future of copyright, which is very interesting because 10 years later we can look back at what he said, by Ronald D. Moore, who was instrumental in
TNG and Deep Space Nine.
Yeah, in birthing those but later Battlestar Galactica.
Anyway, once I read this script and I'd been alerted to it a bit in advance by the people who were raving about it, I read it and I said to myself, aha! Since the storyline is, in fact, about a black science fiction writer in the 50s who is trying to get published in the magazines and trying to star, have a story star a black character, then I do not believe Stephen Barnes will be able to resist novelizing it.
No.
And I called up his agent, explained. She said, well, he's still very busy, but send it to him.
Yeah.
Send it to him. So I sent it off to him. And he called me back about a day and a half later and said, okay, I'll do it. Call my agent. Called this agent. And he took that script and turned it into an amazing novelization. 50% of that book is original content. And it's a nice thick book.
I did read that one. It's top notch.
And it gives the whole background of the character in the past. And it has... what is my favorite cover of all the covers I ever did. In the episode itself, the magazine, I forget what the made-up magazine title was. Can you just pull it up?
No, I can't.
Okay.
It was a play on Astounding.
Yeah, it was a play on Astounding, but sort of a cross between Astounding and Tales to Astonish, something like that, Astonishing Science Fiction, something like that.
There was an Astonishing Science Fiction,
but it was something, I forget, everyone could just check Far Beyond the Stars, Stephen Barnes on Amazon, and they'll take a look at the cover. But the cover is, at one point in the episode, there is a mock-up of the cover of an upcoming issue of that magazine.
Yeah.
And it was a cover right out of the 1950s science fiction covers, just exactly like you would expect on a magazine of the era. But I had to have it, and I snagged it and threw it on the cover, and it's probably my favorite cover of all the ones we've ever done.
Yeah. And I agree. I think that is the single best DS9 episode. And there were sort of two DS9s. There was the Casablanca DS9, where everything took place pretty much on board the satellite itself and down on the planet with all of its politics. And then they added a ship, which was sort of against the original idea. Was it the Destiny? What was the name of that ship?
The Defiant.
The Defiant.
And there was yet another thing that drove me nuts. Because, and this is sort of a subtle thing, Odo was one of the characters. He was a shape-changing alien.
Yes.
He did not know his own origins, and his origins were a secret. That was kept. They sent me all these pictures of the Defiant. They said, we want to keep you in the loop. We want to... make sure you know it so you can start adding the Defiant to stories. And we did, but we didn't know the interior of it or anything. So we would just throw in lines like, the Defiant is off doing this at this to make the book feel more contemporary with the show. What they didn't tell me, because they didn't know until 3 weeks before they wrote it, was that the same episode that introduced the Defiant would also give us the answer to Odo's background.
Yeah.
So
a lot of people liked those. I personally didn't.
Well, whatever it is, what the problem that caused was I had all these books that mentioned the Defiant, but where Odo still didn't know what his background was.
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah. So you've got that same time continuity problem that you're each running in different time streams.
Exactly. And it's very difficult to keep.
And we do have to mention, and I neglected to bring, but it's on analog tape. I should have brought one of the episodes of the Poisoned Arts Minutes. John was instrumental in helping Janet Coleman and David Dozer revive Poisoned Arts by contacting them on a semi-fanish basis and saying, you need to do this. And they said, yes. And we did 5-minute episodes that were called the Poisoned Arts Minutes. And they there were five a week or four a week. And so David wrote arcs that were four episodes. Now, so they brought in actors that they knew for guest episodes. And I and Simon Locley, a writer by the name of Victoria Gang, and an actor that they knew fairly well who had done a lot of movies with Robert Altman and a TV series called Benson, fellow by the name of Rene Auberginois, or Odo, in DS9, we did a whole bunch of four or five episodes on bicycling with him. He was so much fun to work with, a delightful person.
He was asked how he felt about being part of the whole Star Trek thing.
Uh-huh.
And he said, well, I was on Benson. I was on a top 10 show for 7 years. And during that entire 7 years, no one ever came up to me and asked me what happened to my mass when I changed shape.
Yes. And his answer, when I asked him this, we recorded this just before the shows hit the air. He had already filmed, but the shows hadn't hit the air, and I had seen, a pilot or something, and I knew, who the cast was and all that. But he was not yet fully aware of the impact of being a Trek actor. And he was saying, oh, God, when I was in, I was in Benson for 7 or 8 years, and I couldn't even get arrested. And I was going to meet him to give him a script while he was about a block and a half away from BAI at the Pennsylvania Hotel. And he said, oh, meet me in the lobby. I said, it's not going to work. It's not going to work. You're going to be mobbed. And that's when he said, well, I couldn't even get arrested. So sure enough, when I show up there, some Klingons took me to where he was. And he was, like, in shock from the reception. This was his first contact with Trek fandom. And he told me, they asked me what happens to your body mass when you turn into a suitcase. And I said, and what did he say? He said, I don't know. Ask my agent. About 3 months later, I saw him again here at WBAI, or I should say there at, that was two BAIs ago. And he was like, so how are you getting along? Oh, I'm doing a cruise next week. And he so got into it. He had a joyride with that show, and he deserved it. I still like watching him in Robert Altman films myself.
My two
and other old TV shows.
My two most memorable encounters with Star Trek actors while I was working for Star Trek was LeVar Burton and I were guests at the same convention,
mm-hmm.
and he was up on the podium and he did his talking about the show, and then he opened the floor for questions. So I stood up and raised my hand, and he said yes, and he had no idea who I was. And I said, when you're going from warp 5 to warp 6 in a tachyon field, how do you adjust the inertial dampeners to adjust for the space-time anomalies?
Mm-hmm.
And that got a huge laugh.
Which actually is a rather legitimate question. Michio Kaku would appreciate
that. Yeah, and he got a huge laugh. And then, as I figured he must have, he had a comeback line. And he said, you have to understand that LeVar Burton does not comprehend a single word Geordi says. And so he got the top for laughs. But was having lunch with William Shatner. That was very interesting. Very nice man. Very nice old Jewish actor.
Mm-hmm. Maniac.
Very nice, very enthusiastic about everything.
In a positive way.
Yeah. Very enthusiastic way. He was like, I hadn't eaten the particular type of Japanese food we were eating, which was like big crustaceans, and he showed me how to eat it, and we were having a great time. Then he said, excuse me, I have to make a call. And so up until that point, I've been having lunch with a nice old Jewish actor who was very enthusiastic, who, you know, just very nice guy, because I was editing the novels he was part of. And he reaches in, he pulls out a flip phone, and he flips open the phone, and he pushes one button on it for auto dial. He said, it's me. Did you get it done? No? Well, get it done. We're in a hurry on this. Click. And it's like, for one brief second, I was having lunch with Captain Kirk.
Yeah.
And so that's like one of my best memories.
Now, for you and Keith DeCandido and a whole bunch of people, I think Greg Cox as well, the Star Trek for you is TOS, the original series.
I think that actually Keith actually prefers TNG, but certainly for
he's challenged me because I prefer TNG.
Well, you're wrong.
Yeah, well, that's your answer all the time.
Yes.
To which I say, well, you're wrong, and we can do this till we go off the air.
You mean when civilization collapses in 1,000 years, we will still be here going, you're wrong. Especially since I've been rewatching them recently.
I have to do that. I have to do a rewatch.
The original series to me was more willing to have highs and lows, to have episodes like Balance of Terror, which is a, you know, war is at stake, and it's a face-off between two brilliant captains, Kirk and Romulan.
Yeah.
And Trouble with Tribbles, where a whole bunch of Tribbles drops on people.
Yeah. That's a wonderful, wonderful episode. I liked the remake.
The sequel?
Yes.
Yes. It was really good, but the point being that TNG tended to run a much more middle course. With fewer highs and fewer lows and fewer tense, everything is at stakes, and fewer, really, really, really flat out comedies. But
my feeling was that it was better science fiction.
It may have been better science fiction, but what I found, this is something that I only realized when I was actually watching Buffy.
Yeah.
The one of the things you could almost always count on in most original Star Trek episodes was at least once or twice there would be a fight scene or a battle of some kind. And what...
I can almost do the music now.
Yes.
Yes.
And that serves two purposes. And again, this was true on Buffy. When you have those fight scenes, if your show is coming out 30 seconds short, you don't have to worry about adding another unnecessary dialogue scene because you can always stretch the fight scene by 30 seconds.
Right.
And I also found one of the things that bothered me about TNG was eventually they really sort of stopped using the captain's log, and they didn't really use it at all in Deep Space Nine. Mm. And the thing about the captain's log is...
I never noticed that.
In the original series, something would be set up by saying, we are captain's log, blah, blah, Stardate 243.09. We are in orbit around the planet
Schwartz,
yes, which is being racked by war, and we've come to resolve the situation. Now that's how Star Trek would open, and you've already been caught up with everything you need to know.
Yeah.
In TNG, it would open with Mr. Data, have we arrived at planet Schwartz yet? Yes, Captain. And then Riker would turn to Picard and say, Captain, do you think we'll really be able to resolve the war that's going on? In other words, they would do an expository dialogue.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
What had previously been done in the captain's log.
Okay, so here you're talking about a... I had the word a second ago, but it's really the dynamic. There was a different showrunner. That's the single most important difference. DC Fontana, Dorothy Fontana,
and Gene L. Coon, who did not live past the creation of TNG, was Roddenberry wanted the what you might think of as the more preachy episodes. Gene wanted more of the more action oriented episodes.
Yeah.
The result of the teamwork was action-oriented episodes that had a point to them.
Yeah. Coon wasn't he the creator pretty much of Kung Fu, the TV series?
I don't remember.
I believe he was. And I think that sort of like exemplified the kind of show that he was looking after, the sort of like Zen on the one hand and martial arts at the same time. I liked that show. I thought that was well done, and I do believe that was a Gene L. Coon creation.
But in any case, the point being that those are my personal preferences.
My feeling is that the first series was establishing the universe. You know, it's magical in its way.
It was pretty much the first show on television to actually go out of its way to establish a concrete universe that it had created on its own.
Right.
To have star bases, to have a federation, to have revisiting places people had been before.
So that it can be reimagined and still used today, which it is in a number of ways.
And that's, I think, a large part of the reason it's hung on is because of constructiveness.
15 years later, however many years later that TNG, that the Next Generation came on, there was a different era. It's the early 80s. And people were much more concerned in their lives, in their art, with things like diplomacy, with things like multiple culture and stuff like that. And the idea that the captain isn't necessarily the one to go down to fight the alien on the planet.
And yet,
usually you're number one. And yet he did, but they would find a way to explain it.
Right.
Which, you know, with Kirk, they never ever did. I noticed that in the what do they call the universe of the J.J. Abrams universe? There's a name.
New Trek?
No.
Abramsverse?
No. There's a word where...
Alternate universe?
No. I don't know, John.
Okay.
there is a name that the professionals and fans... They distinguish that the upcoming TV series...
Oh, Discovery.
Discovery, which Brian Fuller is creating with Alex Kurtzman, is set back in the old verse. It's set back in the original verse, as opposed to the alternate universe that J.J. Abrams created largely. Well, that's a whole other story involving the Guardian of Time and stuff, but we won't go into that now. But that those two verses have different names that are used by the people that work on the show. And I caught it in an interview with Brian Fuller and so forth. I'm that new series, well, I think, is it as soon as January?
I'm uncertain.
Yeah. We may not have the date. They haven't started shooting yet. They haven't cast it yet. So it's got to be a ways off.
Right. Frankly, I understand why they're setting it back back in time. They're setting it between Pike's ship and Kirk's ship.
Before Kirk's ship.
I think is an unfortunate necessity because of the existence of the movies. Star Trek should always be, and I think Enterprise showed this, Star Trek should always be about pushing on to the next discovery.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and if you're going to call your ship Discovery, set it ahead. Bump it ahead 50 years again.
Yeah, I think there was a problem with the perception of Enterprise. Well, that was a bit of a dud, as far as I'm concerned, the entire thing. And V'ger, as I call it, Voyager, really jumped the shark not too far into its run. I liked some of the individual characters and all that, but I didn't care for the writing.
The problem with Voyager was substantially that every week they would fall into a trap and then escape from that trap. So they were victimized every week and then traumatized and then recovered every week.
Yeah, it just wasn't as well done a show. And
that's what led me to develop New Frontier, the idea of that there should be an exploration of a new area of space that we were going to on purpose that for some reason was not accessible.
Yeah, if I can be so bold, and I will, I think that you created better Trek universes and the people who actually held the keys to the television franchise and movie franchise had in their pockets.
I will take any praise that comes my way.
I'm just saying, this is not for you to comment on. I'm just saying. But there is a point where it jumped the shark and it got old. And I think that J.J. Abrams, who's not necessarily always my favorite producer, I'm not a fan of Lost. I really loved Alias when it began, and then it jumped the shark. And yet somehow he did a really decent job. If you turn off your brain and just watch his first movie for the fun of it and the reinvention of it, he did an excellent job in entertaining.
There were several Star Trek, anti-Star Trek moments that were pushed in.
Yeah.
One was when Spock asks Kirk why he's offering to save the people on the Romulan ship. And it's like, this is Star Trek. You're saving your wounded enemy because that's what you do on Star Trek.
Yes.
So that was a question should not have been asked. And then when the guy said no and his ship was going to be pulled into a black hole anyway, ordering the destruction of the ship by firing everything on the ship was a mistake.
Well, let's not even discuss red matter.
But the bottom line is that what Scotty did not have an arc, and his arc should have been, he's fiddling with a transporter, he materializes Amanda, who's been trapped in this transporter buffer the whole time, and Sarek says, Mr. Scott, you are a miracle worker.
Yeah.
So he didn't really round off the edges.
No, he really didn't, but he was doing what he did with The Force Awakens, with Star Wars, is that he just reimagined something that was beloved and had gone sour in fanish imaginations. And I think that there are a lot of mistakes, there are a lot of problems, especially with his second film.
Right.
But he nevertheless delivers something that brought the franchise back with fun, yes, which had been missing.
But unfortunately, Into Darkness kind of undid that. And then this latest one did not do well, even though it does have a lot of the fun.
Yeah, I liked the third one. It is pretty good. I will say simply, you know what? It doesn't break new ground. It's simply a good episode. It's got a lot of action from beginning to end, which, given its director, Justin Lin, I believe his name is. I haven't seen his, I think Fast and Furious is his franchise.
Yes.
It was simply a lot of fun.
But if you're really
deep, it was a good episode.
Part of the problem is if you're really deep into Star Trek, you notice a couple of things. First of all, the conversation between Kirk and McCoy about Kirk being sort of burned out and wanting to, is lifted completely from The Menagerie or The Cage, the original pilot. It's just the same conversation over the same situation.
Yes, and down to including, you know, the birthday and all that, although they did a lovely spin on that.
Yeah.
There is a moment near the end of that movie that is, by the way, you know, I won't give it five hankies for crying, but it was a good...
Kirk even gets to give a Kirk speech.
He does. But there's a moment in that film that brings tears to your eyes.
But the two other problems, I'll save the worst one for last. One is just an absolutely picky thing. Scotty mentions the ship having been grabbed by a giant green hand.
Yeah.
It was only a green hand in the remastered editions.
Yeah!
It was a flesh-colored hand in the original, and... for us, you know, hyper fan people, it's like, oh, I see. The scriptwriter was watching the remaster, not the original.
The scriptwriter was Simon Pegg.
I know, but he obviously went through all the remastered.
He is as fanish as anybody.
I understand.
On that set.
But here is the thing that was really seriously missing. Nobody slept with the alien woman.
But I'm
really. It's not even a joke. I'm not necessarily meaning that literally, but in Star Trek, the arc is the alien female you meet, whose help you
don't
need,
bang the table.
Does not. Oh, sorry. I thought you were going somewhere else with "don't bang." The alien woman you meet does not help you until after you seduce her.
Okay, well,
and that was a to me that was or just having some sort of romance aspect, because just like every old 60s TV show, a romance lasts one episode. You needed some romance.
Well, yes, but this wasn't the 60s. This is the other verse.
I know.
And as I say, I simply thought that the third film was a lot of fun. It simply I just sat back, didn't think too much about it, and enjoyed the episode, and that's how I see it. It's not an installment. It's not the third movie in the second.
Yeah.
It was an episode, and I enjoyed it on that basis.
And
it
had some wonderful bits, like it's purposely set right after the third year of their mission. After the series.
And they mentioned the five-year mission.
Right, and I could have actually used some more references. I mean, all this stuff, you could have said, Bones, all the stuff we ran into. And the tribbles, and the, you know, just
the thing,
recap.
They're evolving it, and they're settling in,
right?
And I think that they're doing a good
job.
May
be why people didn't want to pay $22 to see it in IMAX.
Yeah, well, I don't mind the IMAX, but I have no use for the 3D. It doesn't do anything for the film, and I did get to see it in 3D, and really, I could do without the headache of wearing the glasses. Even Kubo, which is currently my favorite, most recent film, Kubo and the Two Strings, which I urge everybody to see. Wonderful animated film. Kubo in 3D, it doesn't add another dimension. You're just better off seeing it in 2D. But do let me tell everybody, it's still in theaters. Go see that. The second film I thought could have been saved by simply having Benedict Cumberbatch, let me try this out on you. You're one of the few people that will know the reference that I'm going to make. That instead of Benedict Cumberbatch playing Khan, which is just a thoroughly ridiculous concept from the beginning to end, I don't know what they were thinking, make him Flynn. Okay, now you're going to have to explain that because, as I said, you're the only...
Do you mean Finnegan?
Finnegan.
Yes, do you mean Finnegan? Finnegan was Kirk's arch-rival at the
Academy. At the Academy.
And an upperclassman who picked on him. That
in
would have been nice, but that would not...
In an episode written by, may we point out, Theodore Sturgeon.
However, that was not the problem. The problem was...
That was
that
a
the
problem.
Second, the third movie should have been the second movie. In other words, the second movie had to be already out on the five-year mission, not still trying to get on a five-year mission.
Okay, but all that aside, I'm talking about the entertainment of sitting down and being able to swallow it or not. You're looking at the arc. You're looking at it like a professional in Star Trek, which you are. I'm looking at it as a fanboy, and that's all. And I'm not going beyond that. And the biggest problem that fanboys and girls – had with that movie was Cumberbatch, who, by the way, looks like he'll make a fabulous Doctor Strange, Master of the Mystic Arts, that Cumberbatch is not Khan, that Khan should not have been in the movie. It should not have been a remake of that film at all.
Absolutely. I absolutely agree with you. It should not have been a remake of that film at all. And in fact, I'm just... hoping the next Star Trek film is not going back in time to save the whales, which is Wrath of Khan and Voyage Home, which is Save the Whales. My two favorite movies.
Okay, we agree on that. Surprisingly, we do agree on that. I would say
you're not wrong, Jim.
Yeah, I would say that number two, Wrath of Khan, is the best of the movies, and that number four is the most entertaining.
Well, what I would say is. Wrath of Khan is Balance of Terror.
Yeah.
And Voyage Home is Trouble with Tribbles.
Yeah.
In the same sense that Star Trek always did both drama and comedy.
Mm-hmm.
Voyage Home was a
Well, for a change,
my God, Jim, we can't leave him trapped in the hands of 20th century medicine.
Yeah. No, I thoroughly agree with you. A person who has never seen any Trek could easily sit in on... number four, and just have a great time.
Maybe not. Remember, it starts with Spock recovering.
You can give them a 2-minute previously and that's all that you need.
Right.
That's really all that you need, even if you don't know the characters. And this happened to a friend of mine who just did not know anything about Star Trek and was forced to see The Voyage Home and just thought, number one, it's decent science fiction. Okay, number one. Number two, it's funny, well-done Star Trek with a lot of decent action. As far as funny, let me just throw out lines at people. Okay, everybody remember where we parked.
Where do we keep the nuclear Wetzels?
Yes. I really wish...
Let me guess. You don't use money in the future.
R.I.P. Would have brought that in there, but no, he steered clear.
He took too much LDS in the 60s.
Yes, right. What are they going to do about? This is just a rhetorical question. What are they going to do about Chekhov in the next film? They can't really kill him off, can they?
Well, I have the only thing I've heard is what everybody else has heard, which is that they're thinking of doing some sort of time travel thing.
Ah.
Okay.
Yeah, actually, I did hear that.
What I would like to
do. And if they do that, but then how? What? Then they can find another Chekhov?
They can find Walter Koenig.
Koenig.
Walter Koenig can show up from the future.
As did Spock.
Yes.
Okay.
No, Spock.
Isn't Koenig largely.
Spock
retired?
Showed up. Spock showed up. Yes, from the future. Koenig, sorry, there's no such thing as a retired actor.
Agreed. Well, not agreed.
It just depends on how many zeros there are at the end of the check.
There are some. Some people have said that Daniel Craig has said if I do another Bond film, it will only be for the money.
Right.
But, oh, my God, the money they've offered him to do two more.
Right.
$150 million dollars to shoot two movies.
But I think that you could make it work with Koenig, especially since in this most recent one, the they're going through Spock's things, and they see the photograph from Star Trek VI, the group shot. And
oh, you, spoiler!
I thought
that was the best moment in that film.
Yeah. But in any case, I think you could bring in Walter to have it, especially if you want to do a riff on the Deadly Years, the episode where everybody ages.
Oh, God.
And in fact, it's Chekhov who
the world's worst makeup.
Yes, and but not in this case because they go onto the planet from that episode. He encountered the device, and Chekhov's the one leading the party. And when they get down there, it's Walter Koenig.
Okay,
now that's a fanboy moment. Koenig, that's a fanboy moment.
Okay, yeah, it could work. It could work. By the way, this is WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica Radio, broadcasting at 99.5 FM and also sent out online to the quadrant at WBAI.org. How long it takes to reach another part of the quadrant is another question because...
However much time it takes to get to the story on time.
There you go. Okay, I think we've covered a number of the things. I think it's time for a musical break.
Me too.
So we will do that. And there is at least one piece of music that nobody, especially Kathy O'Connell, WBAI favorite Kathy O'Connell, would ever forgive us if we didn't play it.
It's worse than that. life, Jim, but not as we know it. Not as we know it. Not as we know it. It's life, Jim, but not as we know it. Not as we know it. Captain. Well, it's life, Jim, but not as we know it, not as we know it, not as we know it. It's life, Jim, but not as we know it, not as we know it, Captain.
There's Klingons on the starboard bow, starboard bow, starboard bow. There's Klingons on the starboard bow, scrape along!
Jim.
Captain.
Jimmy!
Fascinating.
Jim.
Captain.
Jimmy!
Jim.
Jim.
Captain. Illogical.
Jim.
Jim.
Captain.
Jimmy!
Jim!
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 Star Trekking across the universe. Star Trekking across the universe.
Change the laws of physics, Jim.
We come in peace, shoot to kill, Scotty, beam me up.
It's worse than that, he's dead, Jim. It's worse than that, he's dead, Jim.
Well, it's life, Jim, but not as we know it, not as we know it, not as we know it. It's life, Jim, but not as we know it, not as we know it, Captain.
There's Klingons on the starboard bow, starboard bow, starboard bow. There's Klingons on the starboard bow, starboard bow.
You can't change the script, Jim, up to you, Jim.
It's worse than that, it's physics, Jim.
Register, engine room, work back to
nine. I'll give it any more to blow, Captain!
Hobbit whom we all admire, with his long wooden pipe, fuzzy woolly toes. He lives in a hobbit hole and everybody knows him. Bilbo, Bilbo Baggins, he's only 3 feet tall. Bilbo, Bilbo Baggins, the bravest little hobbit of them all. Now hobbits are peace-loving folks, you know. They're never in a hurry and they take things slow. They don't like to travel away from home. They just like to eat and be left alone. But one day Bilbo was asked to go on a big adventure to the caves below to help some dwarves get back their gold that was stolen by a dragon in the days of old. Bilbo, Bilbo Baggins is only 3 feet tall. Bilbo, Bilbo Baggins, the bravest little hobbit of them all. Well, he fought with the goblins. He battled a troll. He riddled with Gollum. A magic ring he stole. He was chased by wolves, lost in the forest, escaped in a barrel from the Elf King's halls. Bilbo, Bilbo Baggins, the bravest little hobbit of them all. Home in the land of Shire, that brave little hobbit whom we all admire, just sitting on a treasure of silver and gold, puffing on his pipe in his hobbit hole. Bilbo, Bilbo Baggins, he's only 3 feet tall. Bilbo, Bilbo Baggins, the bravest little hobbit of them all.
While I am dealing with technical issues with Max Schmid, John Ortover will cover and speak to you.
Hi, this is John Ortover on WBAI 99.5 FM. So the quick question, of course, on everybody's minds that everybody's discussing is why Star Trek has lasted so long. I talked about this a little bit earlier. Other than just compelling characters and good stories, or at least 2 out of 3,